Again, that's Marvin Rosen at classicaldiscoveries.org.
I wonder how many of you remember the big folk music scare of the 60s. Boy, that was close. That garbage almost caught on. You know, the other day I was sitting around and thinking, I wonder what the first music ever written in this great country of ours was. And I was certainly hoping it wasn't that fiddle and banjo crap. Lord knows we've come further than that.
To hear how much further we've come, try Music You Can't Hear on the Radio. I'm John Weingart. I hope you can join me Sunday evenings from 7 until 10 for some of the best in fiddle and banjo crap and other great songs and tunes. That's this Sunday and every Sunday from 7 until 10 p.m. right here on WPRB in Princeton.
Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries Goes Avant-Garde. That theme music does indeed let us all know it is time for another edition of Classical Discoveries Goes Avant-Garde. I am your host, Marvin Rosen, and I'm with you for this program every Wednesday between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Good morning. It is 1 minute after 11 on Wednesday, August 3rd, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey, community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Well, I have news for you. Barbara Benary, my guest, is running a little late. Actually, she's not running late. She is stuck in traffic. And what else is new in central New Jersey? So she will be here just as soon as she can. And before she does, I thought we would go right to one of her works. We listened to her Sun on Snow, dating from 1985. This composition will feature soprano Phyllis Clark and also she also performs on percussion. The composer, Barbara Benary, is our violinist, Daniel Good, the clarinetist, John Gibson, the soprano saxophonist, the concertina is played by Jody Kruskal, and Chris Nappi performs on marimba. Our electric guitarist is Nick Ditkovsky. We listen now to Sun on Snow by my guest, Barbara Benary, who hopefully will be here in just a few minutes.
Sunburn where we Oh,
Music by Barbara Benari. You were listening to her Sun on Snow, dating from 1985. In our performance, you heard Phyllis Clark, who was our soprano and percussionist. The composer was our violinist. Daniel Good was heard on clarinet, and John Gibson on soprano sax. Jody Kruskal was our performer on concertina. The marimba player was Chris Nappy, and Nick Ditkovsky performed on electric guitar. And that was from a New World Records compact disc, and that was Sun on Snow, the title track on that. Well, Barbara Benari is here in the WPRB studio after, I guess you could say, a few detours here and there, and we will be talking with her in just a few minutes after we listen to a brief selection. Thank you. All right. You were just listening to Arag Fadina by Barbara Benary, as performed by Gamelon Son of Lion. Well, today I am being joined by American composer and co-founder of Gamelon Son of Lion, Barbara Benary. She received a BA from Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, and an MA and PhD from Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, where her areas of specialization were musics of India and Indonesia. She subsequently taught ethnomusicology at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. She has performed in the ensembles of Philip Glass, John Gibson, Alvin Lucier, Philip Corner, and Daniel Good. She has received a Woodrow Wilson Dissertation Fellowship and commissions from the National Endowment for the Arts, Meet the Composer, and the Jerome Foundation. Benary is co-founder of Gamelon Son of Lion, a new music collective and repertory ensemble in New York City, founded in 1976. She has composed over 30 pieces for Gamelon Ensemble, which have been performed by Gamelon Son of Lion and by other groups in the United States and internationally. Her composition work has been in two areas, ensemble chamber music and theater music. Her styles are various but include process and minimalism and the integration of world music forms, structures, and instruments with traditional Western materials. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, nice to be here.
It's great to have you, and, well, we still have plenty of time despite the detour.
It was nice to see Trenton.
Well, I'm sure they enjoyed seeing you too, but it was really funny. But this part of the New Jersey is just, it's hard to find places sometimes. It is really, despite all of the prep you do. But anyway, that's not important. The main thing is that you are here and we're delighted to see you. Today we are going to talk a great deal about Gamelon Son of Lion and music for Gamelon in general. Before we do, though, share with us, Barbara, a bit about your early experiences in music. How did you initially get interested in it?
Okay, I began violin in childhood when I was about 6, and I played that through all the way up to college, at which point I got a little bored with classical violin literature, and I can't first stop. I never completely stopped playing, but I stopped playing the classical music. And I spent a lot of time with the theater department. And then, this being the 1960s, I happened to hear a concert by Ravi Shankar in New York City. And I said, oh, that's what I want to study. So I went to the dean of my college and I said, I want to study Indian music. Why don't you get somebody in the faculty to teach it? Yeah. Nobody in the faculty knew anything about India. And she said, well, there's a nice program at Wesleyan University. Why don't you become an exchange student? And yeah. I did. So that led me into the world music and ethnomusicology program at Wesleyan.
Very good. So now, did one thing lead into the Indonesian influence or interest, I should say?
Oh, yes. That also happened at Wesleyan. I went to study Indian music there, and I happened into a building where had these beautiful sounds coming out, and I entered a large room full of what looked like very shiny pots and pans.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
And they sounded wonderful. That was the gamelan.
And the rest was history, as I say, I guess, in your... In a way.
More or less.
Well,
they needed extra players, and they gave me an instrument to take home and learn, and I did. And I played both Indian and gamelan music through my years at Wesleyan.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, one of the ensembles you performed with was the Philip Glass Ensemble. Mm-hmm. And you were with this ensemble. I mean, this was very early on during the composer's career. Right. Can you remember the reaction to this music, or I'm sure you do, the general feeling about it? This is going back to when, about 67 or thereabouts, or... 68?
It was about 70.
Oh, was it about 70?
I was already out of undergraduate school at that point.
Okay. So what were, Barbara, some of the, I guess, feelings? Do you have any memories of some of the performances? Just like a little bit nostalgia for you.
Yeah, they were very loud. it was an amplified band of Farfisa organs with a soprano sax that I was playing with. I was the token string player also. amplified. I enjoyed doing it. I just wore earplugs.
Yeah, so it was really a very similar, was it a young group of people in the audience mainly when you were doing these? Or was it a mixed group?
It was a mixed group. There were certainly a lot of young people who enjoyed being overwhelmed with the waves of sound and could just kind of space out on the repetitions.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much attention they actually played to the development that was actually going on during those repetitions.
Yeah.
But they came out saying, "That was cool, man," and looking very stoned.
Let's go back to 1970, because I know that that recording has been reissued, but it was on a very kind of like they say a semi-private when it came out originally.
Right, Chatham Square.
Chatham Square.
Right.
And the problem, I think, when I read about those recordings, which I do happen to own the original LPs on those. But what I do remember about the discussion about those recordings is that they had to do a lot of fading in and out because on the CD it's all one track. Is it right? You know, with when the recordings, the LPs, there was some fading in and fading out, I guess, at the end of the sides.
I don't know, because in performance, the way you performed is you went through the changes and stopped very abruptly. Boop.
And that was it.
That was it.
That was it. Okay.
So the fade-outs were not something that Glass himself ever did.
That were not supposed. No, they weren't. I think what I read was that they were put in the CD, the LPs, when the LPs were done. I read some things about that. When they were able to fix that with the CD releases. It's from this is what I read. But anyway, let's go, Barbara, now to the gamelan.
Okay.
First of all, when did you become actually really interested? This was back in college, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it was during the last year of my undergraduate. I spent about half my time at Wesleyan. But the year before, I went as a visitor. Sarah Lawrence was all women at that point. I think they had a token man or two in the graduate program.
Oh, okay.
Some of whom were not sure they really wanted to be men.
Oh, okay.
So I was socially interested because that's where the boys were, Wesleyan being all male at that time.
Yeah.
So my roommate and I went up for concerts frequently. There was something called Curry Concerts that were hosted by Bob Brown, a professor of ethnomusicology. He had the Indian musicians performing at his farmhouse and served meals to whoever came. It was a very wonderful family experience. Mm-hmm. He also got the gamelan program going there, and I happened upon it, and I loved that sound too, so I started playing in it.
Very good. Well, what I'd like to do is that I have a feeling that there are a number of people listening out there that are hearing the term gamelan for the first time.
Yes.
What is your explanation what that refers to before we go
further?
Well,
it's those shiny pots and pans.
Basically, that's what it is. It's
they're called metallophones, which means a metal-keyed instrument, such as a vibraphone. In fact, vibraphones are sort of modeled on gamelan instruments originally. And a gamelan, excuse me, consists of, that's the core of it, is these keyboard instruments that are tuned in a very non-Western fashion. And it has gongs, hanging gongs that have knobs on them, unlike the flat Chinese gongs. And the knob gives it a particular certain pitch. You can tune your gong, although they're basically cast. And there are drums, which are derived indirectly from Indian drums. And it's a syncretic kind of orchestra. You can add anything to it. During the colonial period, they would throw in brass bands, even, in some pieces, and any other instrument that came their way. A very important instrument is the rabab, which actually came overland from Iran, probably.
Okay. Very interesting. And I'm glad, I'm sure you helped answer some questions for some people as we're going through this. Now, the gamelan Son of Lion, which you co-founded in 1976, how did it get started and how did you come up with its name?
It got started, I was teaching ethnomusicology at Rutgers. I had gotten hired on the promise that I would produce a gamelan for them. At that time, gamelan instruments, which come in sets, were not that prevalent. They were kind of costly to import. I think the going rate with them was about $5,000 to import a set. And some of the sets that were actually being performed at other colleges had come into the country by other means. Wesleyan's, for instance, came from the World's Fair in Flushing Meadows, and two other sets of instruments that stayed in the country and have been used ever since. But other than that, you had to get a set of instruments from a traveler.
Mm-hmm.
Then I met at Wesleyan a man named Dennis Murphy, who was a graduate student himself, and he was a sort of jack-of-all-trades instrument builder who made instruments from junk. So he made a junk gamelan. The first one he put together as a student there consisted of, like, brake drums and hubcaps and milk containers and stuff. But he worked pretty hard on his technology of taking sheet metal, cutting it up, and making the keys that comprise the gamelan. They had food cans for resonators rather than bamboo, because there's more food cans than bamboo in Vermont, where he lived.
Yeah.
So anyway, he put together a little method book on how to make a gamelan. And he gave it to me very generously, and I made a gamelan for Rutgers. And that was Gamelan Son of Lion. And when I left, the instruments left with me.
Wonderful, wonderful. And now the name itself.
The name is a translation from my family name. Ben-Ari is Hebrew. It means Son of Lion. And I guess I gave it that name sort of to say that these are my instruments, not the universities.
Oh, you gave a personal touch to it, I guess you could say.
Well, it was sort of necessary. The political circumstances were such that I faced being fired eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't fired. I was just not renewed and given tenure. And so I could walk out of there with the instruments, which I had basically made myself and bought and paid for.
Yeah, that was a good choice.
It was a good choice.
How many people are performing with you now?
About the same as when we started.
Which was?
We got about 10, give or take, 8 to 10, mm-hmm. sometimes 11, sometimes 12, but you could say like around 10.
Okay. Now, we talked a little bit about some of the instruments vaguely, a little bit. Do you want to add any more detail to any discussion about the instruments themselves?
Well, they're tuned to an Indonesian tuning, which is not diatonic. It consists of two scales. One of them is called Slendro, and it's a pentatonic. But if you took the five black keys on the piano and then stretched them out so they were close to equidistant,
mm-hmm.
you'd have a Slendro. And the other is called Pelog, and that's, you could say, okay, that's the white keys, but that would be not exactly correct. Because it's not seven of them, it's only five. It shares some notes with the other tuning system. It sounds roughly like a D minor with a sharp fourth.
Okay, all right. Because there is, I have to say, the sound on this is incredible. And I mean, if anyone is not, well, you heard a little flavor of it, of course, already today. But the sound of these instruments and with the rhythms and all this, it's really quite an amazing, appealing sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great. How about the training that performers need before they come into your group? I mean, do you have to audition? Or I read somewhere where a big part of it is just a lot of interest at one point.
Yeah, it's basically who would want to come and give a week, every week of their 52 weeks a year.
To rehearse,
sometimes for money, sometimes not for money. Unless they loved it. So interest is the first thing. We look for the background of people who have musical training, first of all, because if a person has no musical training, it will be rather difficult. It doesn't really matter too much what kind of musical training they have. We have people who come from doing Arabic drumming, from doing rock and blues and all kinds of things, sometimes other kinds of ethnic music. And everything is fine because it is a composer's collective. So if somebody wants to adapt, let's say, an Iranian piece or something to the gamelan instruments, they're welcome to give it a try.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. Let's go now to more music. In fact, we're going to listen to a piece called Dragon Toes. Tell us a bit about the work itself.
Let's see, Dragon Toes, that's okay.
Okay.
First of all, I wrote it for my baby back when she was a baby 35 years ago.
That's great.
And it's a process piece based on a system. I called it braid, but basically the idea is our notation is with numbers is five degrees of the scale, if there were. I'd write the numbers in a circle and then kind of go around the circle, three steps forward, one step back, and that, and then that would generate a sequence, kind of like a tone row, which was processed in other ways, in other pieces.
Right, right.
Dragon Toes itself is actually a little poem I wrote for my daughter. She had little slippers that little girls like, shiny slippers from Chinatown with dragons on them.
Oh, okay.
And I was always amused by the fact that she would like something beautiful like a waterfall and be totally distracted by a plastic toy. So it was that sense of novelty.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear this piece now. This is Dragon Toes by my guest, Barbara Benard.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Dragon Toes by my guest, Barbara Benary, as performed by Gamelon, Son of Lion. WPRB wants you to know that Parents Anonymous is a self-help organization for parents that seek to prevent and treat child abuse. It offers free, professionally facilitated self-help groups, a 24-hour toll-free hotline, and a resource library. To volunteer at the hotline or for more information, do call Parents Anonymous at 1-800-THE-KIDS. Again, that's 1-800-THE-KIDS, or you can contact them at 609-585-7666. This has been a public service announcement from WPRB Princeton, community-supported independent radio, where we are joined by Barbara Benary. Barbara, a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Love the wonderful sounds you get out of the gamelan. It's just wonderful. And you've written now over 30 pieces for gamelan, correct? Approximately?
It's probably 35 or more. Who knows? A couple of operas, too.
Oh, okay. Would you like to expand on that a little bit, the operas, just for a moment?
Yeah. My other sideline besides chamber music has actually been theater music, which I started doing as an undergraduate. And whenever the opportunity appears, I do it. So I got this idea to write an opera. First one was based on the Mahabharata, the Indian epic. And it's called Karna. Karna is the anti-hero of the epic. Mm-hmm. He's the good brother who sides with the bad brothers and all of that and gets killed for his troubles. But anyway, I decided to write it as a shadow puppet opera. I love shadow puppets, and I studied them as much as I could. Indonesian shadow puppets generally do plays which are based on the epics, and they're done by a puppeteer who sings and has the gamelan as his backup, and he also speaks and narrates. But I did mine sort of as an oratorio with a six-person vocal group. My puppeteer only did the clown scenes. and the gamelan was a very scaled-down six-person group. So I did that one in 95. Mm-hmm. And around 2002, I did a second one based on the biblical book of Esther, because I thought that book read just like a shadow puppet play.
Yeah. Well, great. That's great. Let's go now to Gamelan, Son of Lion. Go back to that. Are many of the performers composers, and did they always write for Gamelan?
Okay. The answer is yes, no.
Okay, next. No.
You wanted short answers?
No. I don't want short answers on this one.
They are mostly composers, not because they have to be composers, but composers have the most incentive to stay in the group because they're getting their pieces performed. If you're a gamelan lover and aren't a composer, you might stay in there for a number of years too. But at the moment, none of them who are in the group right now happen to be non-composers. And all of these composers pretty much have other musical lives as performers. Very few of them, I think, none of them compose only for gamelan. And so for all of us, including myself, this gamelan was our first experience in composing from gamelan.
Oh, wow, great. So let's talk about some of the performances that the group does. What will you be doing in the future in terms of performances by the group?
Okay, well, this is probably going to be a lean year for us because we lost our major funding. A lot of these sponsors who would hire us have lost their funding or lost the amount of it. So we don't really know for sure. But before this year, we generally did between 6 and 12 performances in a year. Some of them our own productions on grant money, and some of them at the invitation of another sponsor or festival or venue.
Interesting. Do you now go out to schools and share these instruments with the people? I think this would be great, not only for college students, but even for students of a younger age as well. Do you do that?
Yes, we have. In fact, last year we played pretty close to New Brunswick. We were in Highland Park.
Oh, yeah. That is close.
And part of the deal was we did this lovely concert for a community organization. And they set up classes in a school. So we went into the schools and did 3 or 4 classes, including demonstrations of our instruments, a little short shadow puppet show, and the students having time to actually play on a small portable set of gamelan instruments I use for this purpose.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I'm sure the students really found it fascinating. Mm-hmm. To do something like that.
Sometimes in schools where there's more of a residency kind of aspect to it, we can, along with the teachers, have them build puppets and make up pieces and do their own performance.
Yeah, sounds great. Now we've talked about that the performers in the group do compose. How about does the group commission works from non-members?
Yes. One of the premises that we started out with when we first organized was that it should be composers who are established and composers who are new. And we started at Rutgers. 3 of us were professional composers, and a number of us, our students, were student composers. And sometimes, everybody being new to gamelan, sometimes the students would do something that was up there with the professionals. And it was always an interesting mix. So we've kind of stayed with that. If someone wants to join the group and they're a musician or they're a composer, we don't really grill them on, you know, how many grants have you gotten, how many PhDs do you have or whatnot. Yeah. Their music tells the story.
Yeah, that's great. When I was preparing your visit today, I was going through the dates, and all of a sudden It hit me. You are celebrating 35 years now. From 76 to 2011. Mm-hmm. Now, how many composers would you say approximately, members and non-members, how many composers have you presented works?
Well, let's see. When I counted this up last a couple of years ago, it was over 100.
Wow. It's a wonderful opportunity, and it gives. And what's great about it is that it gives composers an opportunity to get involved with very new creative sounds.
Right. Now, so a lot of repertoire was from members of our group or composers who were in our group for a while but are no longer. Some are pieces that composers and other ensembles wrote for their ensemble. So it wasn't like we actually were able to commission 100 people. I only wish we could.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Now, we're going to go now to three sections of a 9/11 memorial suite. And I will be playing, I'm doing on 9/11, this September 10th through September 11th, I'm actually doing a 24-hour marathon of works written in response to the 9/11 attacks. And I will be playing this entire memorial suite then, but I thought we would hear the first opening sections. Barbara, tell us about this and about what we're going to hear.
Okay, well, the group was inspired to do it specifically because where we rehearse is about 8 or 9 blocks away from the World Trade Center. Mm. None of us actually witnessed the event firsthand, but the Daniel, whose loft it we were rehearsing in, heard it. He heard it from the next room. And so anyhow, this was sort of close to home. None of us lost our lives or anybody close to us, but the whole community was very devastated. So anyway, I got the idea to write something. We have, by the way, this is a collective piece, and it's about the fourth collective piece we did. This is an idea. We being a collective, sometimes somebody would have an idea for a theme and say, everybody who's a composer who wants to write a piece for a part of this piece. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time we did it. I just basically invited anybody of the 8 or 9 composers who are in it who felt so inspired to write a little piece, a part of it. Right. And I kind of let off because it was my idea. But also, I wrote a poem for it. And this poem was actually inspired by John Ashcroft, if you remember him. He was the fellow who decided that we were in imminent danger of being attacked on all sides, which many of people felt at the time, and that we should give up any civil liberties we had to give up for our safety. And that really, I wasn't too wild about that. So I wrote this poem, which you'll probably hear several times in this. I don't know if you need me to speak it, but.
No, we can.
No, okay, no. I'll spare you that.
No, I didn't, and you can respect it if you want. We're very informal.
All right. So basically, how do we react to war? And we have to find a wise way to react to the situation without running around like chickens without our heads.
Yeah.
That was my theme. So I wrote this short theme. I myself added a couple of variations to it. And I turned it over to the band and said, either write something that uses the theme or something that doesn't and is completely different. And that's what they did.
Yeah. So we're going to hear three sections. The first is by you, the next is by Laura Libin, and the last we'll hear is by Daniel Good. We listen to selections from 9/11, a memorial suite. Yeah.
trade.